You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. I have a little bit of a frog in my throat, so...
Yeah, we've both been fighting this thing, that's this Trojan thing that's been going around. Yeah. Well, this is a very special Writer's Voices, I would say. It is.
Yeah. You know, we say that often, but this really is, because this is something that a lot of people would like to be able to do, but are not able to. But this gentleman decided he was going to do it, and he did it.
Yeah, talk about following your heart.
Yeah, exactly.
To make the world a better place. Right. So who is our guest today, Mom?
Our guest today is Magnus McFarlane Barrow, and the book is The Shed That Fed a Million Children. And it's true. He is feeding a million children.
And it's an amazing story.
It really is.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Magnus.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
Mom, you want to give a little bit of Magnus's background here?
Yes, he was born in Aberdeen, Scotland, and he started his career as a fish farmer before setting up Scottish International Relief, a charity that later became Mary's Meals. He is married to Julie, a nurse, and they live together in Delmally, in Argyll, with their seven children. And today, Mary's Meals provides nutritious daily meals to more than 1 million children across four continents. That's what's amazing. It's just crazy.
Wow.
But it is. It's wonderful. He started out with a truckload of stuff, and away he went.
Well, Magnus, tell us what made you decide to write a book about your amazing journey.
Well, you know, for quite a few years, people have been saying to me, you know, it's an amazing story. Why don't you write a book? And initially, I wasn't convinced that I wanted to do that, and you know, thought it would be very difficult for me to make the time required to do it justice. But I suppose, over and over again, I see how much people enjoy hearing the story of Mary's Meals, because it is an incredible story. It's a story I never could have made up.
Right.
and you know, I spend a lot of my life giving public talks in different parts of the world, and you know, as I say, I see how people enjoy the story and how they're hungry to learn more about it. So eventually, I decided, yeah, it would be good to write a book, and I suppose it's also because this work we do, you know, even though we're reaching a million children now every day, I hope it's only just beginning, because there are many, many more millions of children still waiting to be fed at school. So I do hope this book can be a vehicle to take the message of Mary's Meals out to a much bigger audience. And then, one other reason too would be that, you know, as this work grows and grows around the world, for me it's very important indeed that we safeguard the values of the work, the spirit behind this work, the ethos, and that's hugely important as we grow rapidly in different places. And I think, I suppose, by writing the stories, the things that happened which led to the birth of Mary's Meals, and those events that kind of shaped and informed our way of doing things, for me that was really important that we did that in this book. That's why I decided to write the book eventually.
Did you have to set aside a huge chunk of time to do this?
No, I didn't, actually. I wasn't able to do that because there's so much else going on with Mary's Meals, and which involves a lot of travel for me, and You know, and also, as you mentioned in the introduction, I'm married with seven children, so I can't just go and shut the door for 3 months or whatever and write a book.
No.
So it was written very much when I could carve out chunks of time. So some of it I wrote in my knee in an aeroplane. Some of it I wrote beside my kids when they were doing their homework. And it worked, you know, it worked for me. Sometimes I had the privilege of spending a whole day writing, but that was rare. And I suppose I would have found it very, very difficult to write it the way I have if I hadn't had quite a large collection of archive stories that I'd written along the way, right from the beginning. I had tended to write down little pieces about different experiences I was having and different thoughts, and that was a godsend to be able to go back and draw on those writings.
Oh, absolutely, because there's so much detail in the book about each country where you were, and if you hadn't made those notes, I don't know how you could possibly have remembered all that.
I know, isn't it funny that when you're having the experience, you think there's no way you could forget any of it, but when you look back to things, and this goes back to 1992, and even before that, the kind of the inspiration for this before that, it's amazing how much you don't remember about things that happened long ago. Well, take us back to 1992.
Don't hope without having written some of that.
Yeah. Take us back to 1992. What were you doing, and what was the kind of the impetus for this journey?
Yeah, so 1992, November, dark, rainy night in our village in Scotland, having a pint of beer with my brother in our local pub, and talking about a very moving news bulletin that we just watched on the television. It was a report on the war in Bosnia, which was at its height at that point. And we felt very moved, partly I think because we'd been to Bosnia many years previously and had experiences there that had really changed our lives as teenagers. So we were very, very interested in what was happening there and appalled as well. You know, like I think many people were at the thought of a war in Europe in our time. I think it was something as young men we thought was a thing of the past, that there would never be a war in Europe in our lifetime. So it was shocking to think of that suffering in a place not very far away and in a place where we had been. So we felt moved just to try and do something small to help, and we just hatched a plan to launch a little appeal to ask people to give us food and clothing and just the basic things that people were in desperate need of at that time in Bosnia. And then about 3 weeks after that conversation in the pub, we found ourselves driving out across Europe from Scotland to Bosnia, which is about a three or four day drive. And had this Land Rover full of all these donations of food and clothing and medicine and so on, and delivered it into a refugee camp, and that was how it all began.
Wow. Now, that seems like quite an unusual thing to do, but you and your brother were raised in perhaps an unusual way that made this more likely that you do it. Do you want to talk a little bit about your upbringing and your parents?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose it might be a bit unusual and probably important in terms of what led me to this work. So we grew up, I suppose, as what you could describe as a devout Catholic family in a part of Scotland where there are very few Catholics. And in 1983, when I was only 15 years of age, we as teenagers read this article in our national newspaper in Scotland. It was just a news in brief. It was like a paragraph, really, saying there's a report that the Virgin Mary is appearing in Yugoslavia, as it was then, And we were amazed because, again, we'd been brought up on the tradition of apparitions of Mary, the mother of Jesus. As Catholics, we knew about places like Lourdes or Guadalupe in Mexico and places of pilgrimage around the world. But we never dreamt for one minute this is something that might happen in our own time. So we said to Mum and Dad, you know, if that's even possible, we should go there and find out. So our parents couldn't come that time. They were busy running the guest house in which we grew up. But they said, well, if you want to go, then go. So we did. You know, so I was the youngest of the group at 15. My sister was the oldest at 19. There were about 10 of us, cousins and friends. And we set off on this adventure to go to Yugoslavia to see what we would find there. And what we did find there was like a very ordinary little sleepy village in the mountains of Bosnia, where these teenagers were claiming that they were talking to the Virgin Mary every day. And we found that the whole village believed them. Every night the church was packed full of 1,000-plus people, farmers and all the local people of that village who totally believed this with all their hearts. And that week we got to know the visionaries. They were the same age as ourselves and got to know many people in the village and came back really believing that this was true and came back with a real desire to try and live our Christian life in a different way, to really put God at the center of our lives. And that's what we tried to do and have been trying to do ever since, often failing, but trying. And in time, that led my mum and dad to turn their what was a guest house into a retreat centre, which it is to this day, a Catholic retreat centre. So the rest of my youth at home was spent in this very interesting environment where people were coming from all over the world to stay in the retreat centre, met many fascinating and good people that way. And I suppose the other, maybe a slightly unusual thing about my youth was that Mum and Dad decided to adopt a young boy, a 7-year-old boy, who became my dear brother, who suffered from a terrible skin disease, and he'd been abandoned by his parents and had lived in care and in hospitals all his life till Mum and Dad took him in. So I suppose, you know, I grew up with parents who were open to making unusual choices in their lives to help other people.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Magnus McFarlane Beryl, the author of The Shed That Fed a Million Children. And if you are listening to this show on Friday, May 29th, I want to mention that Magnus will be in Iowa this weekend. He will be in Solon at St. Mary's Catholic Church for a talk and book signing tonight, May 29th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. He will be in Indianola on Saturday, May 30th at Smith Chapel at Simpson College, which is where my wonderful niece Katie recently graduated. And he will be in West Des Moines also on Saturday at 5:30 p.m. So Saturday morning, 8:30 to 10:30 in Indianola at Simpson College, and Saturday at 5:30 p.m. at St. Francis Church on Ashworth Road in West Des Moines.
Yeah, we'll give that again. Mm-hmm. We'll give that information.
Right.
In the
and
program.
Do you have any other Iowa dates, or is that everything?
I think that's all of them, as far as they've told me. They might sneak in a few more when I'm there, but I don't know about them yet.
Well, when Mom and I mentioned that we were going to be interviewing you to my sister, Anne Lemansky, she said, oh, I've met Magnus. She met you at a conference somewhere. Apparently, her children are homeschooled, and a good friend of theirs in, I believe she said, Wellman, Iowa, raises a lot of donations for Mary's Meals. And
amazing. It's a small world.
It is a small world. Yeah, so she met you through that person. I don't know her name, but it's just, and it's a high school student. And it does seem like you have inspired a lot of people to reach deep into their hearts and their pockets to help in this in this mission?
Well, the thing that...
That's really been the thing that's just overwhelmed me over and over again is people's goodness. And it's the reason this work grew. I never planned at the beginning to do any more than that one-off delivery of aid to Bosnia. And it's really just the response of people and people's generosity that have fueled this, what's become this global movement. So people's kindness never, ever ceases to amaze me.
Well, what's interesting, too, about this work is that because the children eat there at school, they come to school. And otherwise, they might not come to school, very likely might not come to school. So they're able to be educated, too. That's the wonderful, I'm a retired teacher. That's the wonderful thing about it to me.
Yeah, Magnus, let's talk a little bit about how you came to that as being the primary mission, feeding children at their place of education, because that's not where you started.
Sure. No, absolutely. And you know, for the first 10 years after that delivery of aid to Bosnia, we were doing all kinds of different things, children's homes in Romania, you know, healthcare in West Africa. And this simple work of Mary's Meals, that's all about providing one meal every day in a place of education, that was born in 2002 in Malawi, in southern Africa. And that year was a terrible year of famine there. And I was there initially, helping emergency feeding projects, buying food in cities and taking it to villages where people were starving. And during the course of that work, I met this family. They lived in a small mud brick, two-room house. The father of the family had died sometime previously, and the mother was dying when I met them. And she was called Emma, and Emma had her six children around her. And after some time, I started talking to her oldest child. He was called Edward, and he was 14 years of age. And at one point in the conversation, I said to Edward, Edward, what are your hopes? What are your ambitions in life? And he looked at me and he said, I would like to have enough food to eat, and I would like to be able to go to school one day. And that was it. That was the extent of his ambition at 14 years of age. And that's something that I'd encountered over and over again in the world's poorest communities, meeting children who weren't going to school because they were hungry, because they were working in the fields, because they were begging, really just doing whatever it took to put the next meal on the table, and therefore missing out on school and the education that can set them free from poverty. So those words of Edward's really, really resonated in my heart and were a huge part of the reason why we decided to start Mary's Meals. You know, this simple way of breaking that cycle of poverty that he and so many others are trapped in by providing that good meal every day in school to meet their immediate need for food, but to do it in a way that enables them to come into the classroom.
So, because chances are that's the only meal that a lot of these children will have in a day's time.
Sadly, that's very true. Mm-hmm. Very, very few children in a country like Malawi would ever eat before school. And even today, you know, the hundreds of thousands that we're feeding, for most of them, it would be their main or only substantial meal of the day.
Wow. And how do you... What are the logistics behind feeding a million children? How do you pull that off?
Well, first of all, I think absolutely key to why this works is that it's owned first and foremost by the local community. So that's the first thing we establish when we go into a new village or community that asks us for Mary's Meals. We establish that they are willing to take responsibility for the daily cooking and serving of food, and all of that's done by local volunteers. To give you an idea, in Malawi alone, there are over 65,000 Malawian volunteers giving up their time unpaid to make this happen. So that's a key part of the model. So that day-to-day work is the responsibility of the chiefs and the head teachers and the local community who volunteer. then our job becomes procuring the food. And again, with that, we have a very strong philosophy that as much as possible, we want to buy locally grown food so that we support the local farmer, so we support the local economy. So we buy that food and we deliver it to the schools. And at those schools, we build, with the community, we build a kitchen and a storeroom so that the food can be securely stored there. And then we have a team of monitors, our own staff, who go out on motorbikes and who visit the schools at least twice a week. And they are checking, they're doing stock checks and making sure the food is being used the way it's meant to be used. They help train the volunteers in safety and hygiene when they're doing the cooking. And they also collect data about what happens when we start serving meals, because very amazing things do happen, and huge increases in enrollment and improved attendance and improved academic performance. And so we're doing a lot of work to collect the evidence of what happens. So in very broad terms, that's how it works. It's actually a very simple it's a very simple model. You know, of course there are big challenges in some of those environments in which we work in terms of lack of good roads and so on. But it's a very simple model, and one that can be replicated quite easily.
Then you also have started the schools have a garden of their own in some places. That's really great, because it teaches the children how to garden. And they can eat some of the things that they grow.
That's right. In Liberia, that would be a sort of key component of the project. Now, in Liberia, many of the children lost the farming skills as they were all refugees growing up, and. So those school gardens also are a way of reintroducing those skills back into the community. And in addition, the produce is then contributed back into the daily menu. So it's wonderful, you know. I don't think it's realistic to think that the schools can run farms big enough to supply all their daily meals. Otherwise, you would have children working on the farms all day, which clearly isn't the objective. But I do think every time we find an opportunity to get the community more involved, and every time we find an opportunity to help make this sustainable and help people to grow more food of their own, we absolutely want to do that.
The other thing that I thought was great was the backpack project.
It's a beautiful project. Yeah, we discovered when we started serving the meals that many children were coming to school for the first time, but many of them didn't even have a pencil or a pen or a notepad. So we launched an appeal in Europe, in Scotland initially, asking school children to fill backpacks, school bags, with basic educational items, and those we ship out, and it's a wonderful project. I should say we haven't actually started that here in the US yet, but it's something we would like to do eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said in your book that there was 400,000 backpacks had been sent at the time you wrote that. That's a lot. That's wonderful. I can only imagine what those children, what their faces looked like when they opened those and saw pencils and paper and
It's a very beautiful thing to be able to go and experience that joy. It's just overwhelming. You know, these are kids that won't ever have received a birthday present or a Christmas present, and to suddenly receive this bag of beautiful goods packed by someone on the other side of the world that they don't even know, it's just incredible. You know, the joy and the sense of surprise and gratitude that people have.
I wanted to mention some of the kind of accolades that Magnus has received for his work. He has been named to the 2015 Time 100, Time Magazine's annual list of the 100 most influential people in the world. That's quite an accomplishment. How do you feel about that, Magnus?
Embarrassed. pianist, mainly. you have to take things like that with a very big pinch of salt. You know, I always cringe a little bit at getting personal awards because, you know, Mary's Meals, if it's anything, it's a movement of lots and lots of us doing small things. You know, none of us have to do anything spectacular. But at the same time, you know, something like that award, it is a wonderful gift in enabling us to tell more people about this very important thing that we do. So it's great from that point of view, even if a little uncomfortable personally.
And you were also named a top 10 CNN hero in 2010. We have a former Fairfielder who won that award one year, Robin Lim, who works with providing maternity care in Bali, I believe. And, you've met Pope Francis. You've had lunch at Buckingham Palace with the Queen and Duke of Edinburgh. And many, many other accolades, but as you say, they're just to bring attention.
Not to him, but to the
project. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And
no, that's right. That's exactly it. So, yeah, and obviously it can be good fun sometimes as well, meeting those people or finding yourself in environments that you never expected. I never expected to be having lunch in Buckingham Palace, for example, that's for sure. You know, they're gifts as well, I think. I thank God for those too.
Yeah.
Well, tell me, do you, this food that they prepare, is it like, there's another program called Kids Against Hunger, which started in Iowa, and they have a casserole that we bag. We did it at church. We bag it up and we raise the money to send it then. And it's a casserole, and then it's water's added to it and it's cooked. Is yours something like that, or what are your meals like?
Ours is very much based on what's locally available because we want the food to be sourced in the countries where we work. We think that's really important in terms of helping the local farmer, the local economy.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, in Malawi, that would be a corn soya blend. They call it Lukuni Pala, which is really made of their maize and soya. Some added sugar, and then it's fortified with vitamins and minerals. So it's a very very nutritious and it's a great meal for growing children, but it's also extremely inexpensive and all locally available. So, you know, in Malawi, we feed over 700,000 children every day, and everything they eat is grown in Malawi. So that's a very important thing for us.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in other countries, for example, Liberia, it would be more rice and vegetables and some fish. So it's very much according to local taste and what's available.
Well, that's good because local taste, that's the secret, even, you know, for success.
I know. I've heard stories in the past of food being sent from the United States to help somebody, but it wasn't food that they would want to eat,
that they were familiar with.
And I'm sad to say I've seen that, and not just in the United States, other parts of the world too. And, you know, even I know that's always well meant, but it can be problematic, and it can also be problematic in terms of undermining the efforts of the local farmers as well. You know, if big quantities of aid, food aid, come in while they're trying to grow crops and sell them, it can undermine that development as well.
Absolutely, and I think the aspect of Mary's Meals, the locally grown aspect, is really important.
Yeah, it is.
We're trying to, here in Fairfield and other communities around the Midwest, we're trying to promote locally grown, buying local, eating local as much as possible, even just, you know, even for us, because we want to. In fact, I'm on the board of the Sustainable Living Coalition, and that's their mission, is to promote local food production and eating and organic food production.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
yes, it's like crazy to be moving food about all over the world all the time.
So, oh yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Magnus McFarlane Barrow, and he is from Scotland. The title of his book is The Shed That Fed a Million Children. Tell us about The Shed.
Well, back in 92, I explained to you about collecting that aid, and I asked my father if I could borrow his shed next door, and he said yes, thinking I would use it for a week or two, maybe. And so 20 years later, I still haven't given the shed back. It's become my office, become the global HQ of Mary's Meals. And, you know, I suppose it's a little bit unusual at this stage to have an office like that. But I think it's really important and really appropriate, you know, that we... it keeps us rooted, you know, it reminds us how we began, and also, you know, because we have such a strong commitment to being low cost, you know, when people donate money to us, they donate money so that we can feed hungry kids, not so that we can build fancy offices. So it's important for lots of reasons, I think, to stay rooted in the shed, and it's no sacrifice. I like my shed. I quite enjoy being there.
Magnus, would you read a section from The Shed That Fed a Million Children?
Yeah, of course. Happily do that. So this first little bit I'll read is taken from a little time after we began Mary's Meals in Malawi. And it's just an encounter I had when I went back to a school there. Ruth and I visited Mzedi School, just outside Blantyre, with Peter and Carter. The school was tucked into a rocky hillside, among little patches of cultivated soil, ready for planting and patiently awaiting the rains. "Small Peter! He's alive!" exclaimed Peter and Carter, recognizing a boy in the crowd of children who surrounded us as we parked in the school playground. "I was sure that child was dead," he said, as we climbed out of the vehicle. He pulled the little child, perhaps 4 years old, to himself and hugged him. Then he held him at arm's length and delighted in his appearance. An older boy stood beside him, with eyes that looked too large for his solemn face, and legs too thin to support his frame. "Your brother looks well, Lazaro," Peter said to him. The boy nodded his head and smiled. Peter then told us their story. Some months back, the teachers at Mzedi had noticed that Lazaro, who had previously been a very punctual boy, had begun to turn up late every morning without explanation. They investigated and discovered the mother of the family had died, leaving Lazaro and small Peter at home on their own. Some distant relatives sometimes visited but gave little support. Lazaro, who looked about 8 but was actually 12 years of age, became the head of the household and tried to look after his little brother. But they didn't have enough food at home, and Lazaro depended almost entirely on his daily meal at school. Old Peter inevitably fell sick. As he grew weaker and weaker, Lazaro decided, literally, to take matters into his own hands. He knew that Mary's Meals were providing food not only in his own primary school, but also in an under-6 centre, half a mile away from their home. He started to carry Peter there every morning, and only after he had deposited him there safely, knowing that he would be fed and cared for, did he continue to school himself, arriving late and tired. When Peter and Carter had visited some weeks ago, he'd heard that the carers at the under-6 centre had taken small Peter to the hospital and were not hopeful he would survive. Weeks without food had taken their toll. But here, right in front of us, was a bright-eyed, smiling small Peter, with the hand of the brother who saved him on his thin shoulder.
That was Magnus McFarlane Barra reading from The Shed That Fed a Million Children. Magnus, what are some of the biggest challenges you've faced in getting Mary's Meals up and running?
Well, so day in, day out, there's the, you know, there's the logistical challenges, you know, working in countries where there are very few decent roads, they're very often overcome by just by the desire of the community to be part of Mary's Meals. So, you know, for example, recently a community on top of a huge mountain on Malawi, 3,000 feet up, like 3 hours walk from the nearest road, asked us for Mary's Meals. And initially I said to them, well, it's just, I don't see how it's possible to get the food to you. And they said, well, you know, we'll come down the mountain if you take it to the bottom and we'll carry it up. And that's what happens. We've begun and they do that. So those problems are, there's always a way to overcome them. Again, day to day, there's the challenge of corruption, you know, corruption at government level and in all sorts of ways. And you know, that's overcome by the robust organization that we've built and that way of monitoring the project that I described. And also, and maybe even more importantly, that local ownership model becomes self-policing, because most of the volunteers who come to the school every day to cook and serve the food are parents or grandparents or aunts, and they wouldn't take kindly to people trying to steal the food that's for their own children.
Yeah.
So it becomes very self-policing in that regard as well. So that really works. It is very, very robust, and you know, the donations that we receive absolutely translate into food every day for hungry children. So that works. I suppose, you know, bigger challenges at this stage relate just to the rapid growth of Mary's Meals around the world, you know, and I touched on it when I described why I've written the book. For me, you know, it's very important that we feed more children, but it's not all about numbers, you know, and growth. It's about doing this work the right way, you know, that it always remains mm-hmm. a work of love that is focused on the child in front of us, you know, that little boy, small Peter, that I just read that piece about. It's about individual children. I don't want to become a kind of cold, anonymous organization that talk about projects and delivering strategic plans or whatever at the expense of losing sight of that. And so, you know, for me, protecting our values, the way we do things, is really, really dear to me. And as I say, one of the reasons I've written the book. And when you grow rapidly in different parts of the world, then there can be a challenge around that, and making sure that we get the right people coming into the organisation who will uphold those values, as well as having the right skills as well.
You said in your book it's important that we treat those who receive our aid with as much respect as those who give to us and make the Mary's Meals possible. I think that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the poor aren't the, we shouldn't see them as the problem. You know, we should see them as the primary builders of something better. You know,
mm-hmm.
I never want this work to become about, you know, a wrong notion of those of us in the more wealthy countries being the givers and people in Africa being passive receivers. It's absolutely not like that. It's a whole lot of us walking together with the same goal, that the hungry child can be fed each day. And we can all do different things, whether it's donating, whether it's volunteering, whatever it might be. I don't think there's anyone in the world who can't play a part in the mission of Mary's Meals one way or another. And we're all equally important. We've all got something unique to bring to this, and I feel very passionately about that.
Much of the support for Mary's Meals comes from grassroots support throughout the world, from donations to fundraisers to checks sent from people in prison. What are some of the most surprising and creative ways that you've seen people get involved in Mary's Meals?
You know, more and more I see that it's young people that are leading these really creative ways of fundraising and of raising awareness of this work, which is so important to us. So, you know, all kinds of things. And they're so good at, you know, at social media, for example. They come up with wonderful ideas around that as well. And we've got groups like right now in California, a group there called Teens for Mary's Meals have started fundraising because we have a system where we allow particular groups or donors to fund a specific school, which we put their name on and which we send reports back on and so on. And so that group, like many other groups, set out to fund one school, and then they've ended up, I think at last heard, they were onto their fourth school that they're now providing Mary's Meals for. So it's wonderful. Since the beginning, people have just been astounding me, and I think really changing me by their acts of generosity. I don't know, would you have time for me to read a very short piece that relates to that?
Yes, that'd be very good. Go ahead.
So this is near the beginning of the work, it's a lady called Mrs. Duncan Jones who had a huge impact on me. Mrs. Duncan Jones lived in a little cottage, the sort you read about in fairy tales, at the end of a very rough track near the village of Kilmartin. We always enjoyed visiting her with our van to collect various goods, both our own donations and things she had collected from friends in the area. Each time we visited her, she would give us wonderful bowls of homemade soup, and, in order to provide sustenance on the journey to Bosnia, she baked us the most delicious fruitcakes I've ever tasted. These cakes contained a truly amazing quantity of brandy. She would sometimes leave them for us to collect at a particular filling station on our road to Glasgow, neatly wrapped, along with a note of encouragement. Her husband, an Episcopalian minister, died shortly after we met her, but her hard work and support of our efforts never wavered. Once I remember visiting her to collect yet another pile of donations. When she served me my soup, I noticed that, rather than a ladle, she used an old mug to fill my bowl. I began to look around her kitchen at her empty cupboards and shelves, and noticed nearly everything was gone. Worried, I asked her if she was okay. "Yes, fine," she smiled. "Are you moving house?" I inquired. No, I love it here. No, I just thought about those families in Bosnia returning to their homes with nothing at all. They need these sorts of things more than I do now. I mean, does an old lady like me, living on her own, really need a ladle or extra plates and pots?" I trundled down the hill from our home, my van full of our household belongings, and carefully wrapped cake on the seat beside me. In my rear-view mirror, I could see Mrs. Duncan Jones waving. She wore a wonderful, huge smile.
Thank you for sharing that from the shed that fed a million children. Magnus, you have a quote in the book from Pope Francis. It says, "Poverty in the world is a scandal. In a world where there's so much wealth, it is unfathomable that there are so many hungry children, that there are so many children without an education, so many poor persons. Poverty today is a cry." Do you think that it's possible to feed all the hungry children in the world? Do you think we will see that day where no one goes to bed hungry?
Certainly think it's possible that every child in the world at least can receive one good meal every day in their place of education. That's our vision for Mary's Meals, and I really believe that's possible. You know, of course, I don't think it's the responsibility of Mary's Meals alone to make that happen, but, you know, the more time goes on and the more I see this work grow and the way it changes lives, I can't understand why that's not possible in this world of plenty, in this world where we grow more than enough food for all of us to eat well. You know, so that vision burns ever more brightly for us. You know, I think it's crazy that, today probably around 18,000 children have died of hunger-related causes. You know, over 57 million children out of school because of poverty today. I think that's insane. So I do believe, you know, that vision can be realized. I don't know, you know, if it's ever possible that no one in the world experiences chronic hunger. I would like to think so. And I think there's no good reason for children to be hungry.
So what countries does Mary's Meals operate in now?
So we're in 12 countries where we deliver the meals. Most of them are in Africa. So Malawi, by far the biggest, Liberia, Kenya, Uganda, South Sudan, Zambia. Then we're also in Haiti. We're in India. We're in Burma and Thailand as well.
And do you still...
Ecuador too, I forgot.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Do you still do any work in the areas where you started, in Bosnia and Romania?
Well, still in Romania, we're doing small projects there still, but really, no, more and more the focus of our work is the very poorest countries of the world, which, you know, mainly that's Africa and Haiti and parts of Asia. But it's a beautiful thing, actually. In some of those places where we first delivered the aid, in Croatia, you know, where many of the refugees were, where we were delivering aid to, the friends I made at that time, who were recipients of our aid, now run a Mary's Meals organization to fundraise for us. So they are now part of the Mary's Meals mission on the other side of the equation. I think that's a very beautiful thing to see.
It is indeed. Let me ask you this. If in some of the countries, like in South Africa, where there is turmoil, political turmoil and war and so forth, does that makes your job more difficult, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. You know, to carry out our mission the way we want, we need children in schools that are operating. You know, so that can be very difficult at times of war, and sometimes you know, in extreme circumstances, we need to adapt our work to more emergency response. But thank goodness that's been very very rare. But yeah, of course, war makes things, everything becomes very difficult in times of war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Magnus, another way that you've drawn attention to this work is through a documentary called Child 31. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's just a wonderful film that's attracted a lot of attention and won awards, and made by a filmmaking company called Grassroots. And it really tells the story of Mary's Meals, really through the voices of the children who receive those meals, we really, you know, watching the film, you really get to know two or three amazing children living in very extreme situations, and it's incredibly incredibly moving. Not in a depressing way. It's full of hope, because really it's telling the story of Mary's Meals, which is a happy, hope-filled story, and it's moved many, many people around the world. It's a film. It's called Child 31, and people can view that on our website. And I'm delighted to say that the director of that film is now making a new film for us that will be available to view later this year. And that film's going to concentrate very much on the amazing new generation of young people who are leaving school, having benefited from Mary's Meals, and who really are the hope now for their countries. They are in university, they are some of them are in paid employment or starting businesses, and they're the people that can change things for their countries.
Now, of course, all the proceeds from this book are going to feed Mary's Meals, right?
Yeah, 100% of the royalties of the book go to Mary's Meals, so I don't take anything from the book at all.
One of the titles...
It's incredible to think, you know, when we're talking about that vision and if it can be realized that, you know, on average, globally at the moment, it costs us $19.50 to feed a child for an entire school year. You know, so a little goes a long way with Mary's Meals, and it, to me, it makes it even more insane that children are dying of hunger today.
Yeah, it really does. And what does Child 31, what does that mean? The title of the documentary.
I never like to answer that question because we named it that partly to encourage people to watch the film and to try and figure that out. And it's a little bit ambiguous. I suppose it's fair to say you might watch the film and still not fully understand why it's called Child 31, but there are some big clues in there. So I'm afraid I won't answer that question directly. I would just encourage people to go and watch it and try and figure that out.
Okay, Child 31, and that's on your website. And what is the URL for your website?
So it's just MarysMealsUSA.org.
Okay, MarysMealsUSA.org. And I'm assuming you can donate on the site?
Absolutely, and buy the book as well, The Fed a Million Children.
Right. And, I want to tell people that this is just, in some ways, a fun book to read. I mean, it's about a very serious subject, but... Your writing style is so personal and anecdotal.
Yeah, it is.
You're telling some great stories in this book.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that because you know, even in the most kind of dark situations, funny things happen. You know, a lot, and I wanted to share that too. So yeah, it's not a gloomy, depressing book. I don't think it is anyway.
No, it's not. It's a book full of hope and right. Real people and people that you like reading about.
Yeah, because they care about. They care.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's a good thing. Yeah. It's a good thing you took all those notes, though.
And one thing before we only have a couple of minutes, but you don't go into a great deal of detail in the book about this, but you met your wife through the work that you were doing to Bosnia, like right at the very beginning. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So she's a nurse. Gave up her job in Scotland to try and help in Bosnia during the war. And she phoned me to say, "Can you?" She'd heard I was driving aid there and asked if I could take her to Bosnia and introduce her to some people in the hospitals. And so I did. And in the end, she ended up driving trucks with me. And turned out she was a much better truck driver than I was. She passed her test first time to drive the big trucks, and I failed. But anyway, that's how we met, and that's been a real blessing in so many different ways. But you know, Julie's been as passionate about this work, you know, from the very beginning of our whole mission, our whole organization, and that's been a huge blessing and source of strength and support for me in our own marriage.
Was there something in particular that made you decide you were going to devote your entire life to this? Because obviously when you started out, that wasn't your intention. But
well, it really was people's goodness, you know, that you know, I just feel like from the very beginning I've kind of been swept along by this huge wave of goodness coming towards me. I never feel like I've made this happen because I haven't. You know, I've just found myself in this situation and I've done my best to support it and manage it and look after it. But people's generosity, kindness, that's the kind of driving force from the beginning, and I love that. You know, it restores my faith in human nature anew every day.
Magnus, we can definitely tell you're in New York City. We can hear all the sirens in the background.
That's definitely not the noise in my shed in Scotland, in New York. You're quite right.
Hey, I want to reiterate here, on Friday, May 29th, Magnus will be at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Solon, Iowa, from 6:30 to 8:30. And on Saturday, May 30th, he will be at Smith Chapel at Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa, from 8:30 to 10:30. And then on Saturday, he will be at St. Francis Church in West Des Moines at 5:30 p.m. for a question and answer and book signing and all those places. And I encourage, if you live in any of those areas, please take the time to go and meet this man and learn about this.
And is this your first trip to Iowa?
No. I have a lot of good friends in Iowa. I've been there several times. And I would say, in all honesty, that Iowa is the most incredible home of support for Mary's Meals. It's the strongest support for Mary's Meals in the whole of the U.S. is in Iowa. So
wow.
I'm very much hoping to meet some new people in Iowa these days, but I'll also be looking forward to meeting a lot of old friends.
Well, we're looking forward to having you here. And wish you every success as you go forward with your mission, because it's an important one.
Yeah, and you know, I myself, I got 19 appeals today in the mail, okay? And I don't know if all of these are legitimate, but we know this is legitimate.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That there's a difference there. Yeah. Definitely.
Well, thank you so
much. Thank you. And thank you for having me on your show as well. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. We really did. We really enjoyed having you.
We certainly did.
And, Mom, you have some parting words for us today?
Yes, I do. Whether your glass is half empty or half full, just be thankful that you have a glass with something in it.
And see you next week on Writer's Voices.
And I just want to remind you, get those entries in for the Ink Fingers 2015 Creative Prose Contest to win a publishing contract at First World Publishing. The deadline is May 31st, and details are available at writersvoices.com.
Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUU-FM.com and writersvoices.com.